From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Emerging artists for you tonight. All their information at our website at coasttocoastam.com. And in a moment, a special four-hour report on the Mars rover Curiosity, which is about to land on Mars, fingers crossed, in about 24 minutes. We'll have various guests throughout the evening, your phone calls, and of course, Richard C. Hoagland from the EnterpriseMission.com and our science advisor will co-host tonight's program with me as we just wait for this incredible news. But again, tragedy across America. Seven people shot and killed at a Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, in what officials are treating now as a case of domestic terrorism. Though police have not given full details on the identity or motive of the shooter or released much of the identities, they say that the news of the shootings are the work of a white supremacist or skinhead. This evening, the FBI and a bomb squad arrived also at a home in Wisconsin just to check things out. In addition to the seven confirmed dead, three people, two adult male civilians and a male police officer in critical condition, fighting for their lives, being treated at a local hospital. The apparent gunman was shot and killed in an exchange of gunfire with the wounded police officer outside the temple and was one of the seven dead. Douglas Hagman with us, who monitors terrorist websites. Douglas, would you go as far as to say this is domestic terrorism or just an act of another wacko?
Well, I would say this. I think that the designation as a domestic terrorist is rather convenient. I think we need to treat that designation with a healthy dose of skepticism at this point. Until we know more, I think that that designation was made early on, perhaps to control the information coming out of this scene, this event, this tragedy, as opposed to what happened in Colorado just 16 days ago, where local law enforcement maintained control of that for a good period of time before the federal government became involved. In this case, the federal government declared this a domestic terrorist incident and put the lid on this right away. So the information now is being controlled. So I think the designation in this case is more of a way to control the information coming out of the scene.
Doug, I have to tell you, though, if these episodes continue in this country, there's going to be an outcry for gun control. I can feel it. I can see it. And I bet you do, too.
Absolutely. And I don't think that's necessarily by accident either. We've got more people that have been killed by gunfire in the last 24 hours in Chicago than at the temple.
Sure.
You know, and so we have to put this in perspective. Rather than try to exploit this for political purposes, we need to address the evil that's behind this and everything else that's going on.
Okay, Doug, thank you so much. And let me tell you a little bit about the Sikh religion. It started in the 15th century in Asia. I know many people who just practice this religion on a regular basis. They are very heartwarming, lovely people. Another horrible situation, this time in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. Full details coming up, of course, I'm sure, on your local news and other newscasts throughout the week on this story, which is not going to go away. Iran has fired an upgraded version of its short-range ballistic missile in a successful test of its ability to hit stationary land or sea targets. The missile now has a range of more than 190 miles, can be fired at targets in the Persian Gulf and Sea of Oman, as well as land-based targets. Now, the Iranians say, hey, this is only a deterrent missile. We are not going to use it unless people have bad intentions towards us. Chemotherapy can cause damage to healthy cells, well, we've always known that, which triggers them to secrete a protein that sustains tumor growth and resistance to further treatment, according to a study. Researchers in the United States made the completely unexpected finding while seeking to explain why cancer cells are so resilient inside the human body when they're very easy to kill in a lab. They tested the effects of a type of chemotherapy on tissue collected from men with prostate cancer and found evidence of DNA damage in healthy cells after treatment. Chemotherapy works by inhibiting reproduction of fast-dividing cancer cells, such as those found in tumors. The federal government has quietly completed an audit of U.S. gold stored at the New York Federal Reserve near Wall Street. They're not saying exactly how much, People are estimating $21 billion worth there. They'll probably have the announcement by the end of the year. One of the most daring space missions ever undertaken is nearing Mars. In the next few minutes, NASA will attempt to land its one-ton Curiosity rover on the red planet to study the possibility that this world may once have hosted some kind of life. Richard C. Hoagland, our science advisor and head of the EnterpriseMission.com, will be with me for the entire 4 hours tonight. Richard, give me a timeline on what's going on here.
We're waiting now for the first Odyssey spacecraft relay of live data from Curiosity, which is almost approaching now 10,000 miles per hour. Mars gravity has gripped it. It's supposed to land in about 20 minutes, 22 minutes maybe. And the next data point will be the separation of the cruise collar around the reentry vehicle itself. And that has to happen. It has to be ejected. Otherwise, Curiosity will burn up in the Mars atmosphere.
It sure will. All right, Richard, stay with us. We're going to take this quick break. We're going to come right back and talk with you this hour. Then for the rest of the night tonight, folks, along with Richard Hoagland, Dr. John Brandenburg joins us. His book, Life and Death on Mars. Robert Zubrin, you know Robert, a regular guest here on Coast to Coast AM. In our last hour, David Livingston joins us. He's the host of a space show and knows all about Mars. And in addition to all of that, we'll be taking your phone calls throughout the night as we watch and monitor NASA with our fingers crossed, because in about 20 minutes, Curiosity is supposed to touch down on Mars. We shall see what happens. I'll be back in a moment with Richard C. Hoagland on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie, Richard C. Hoagland with us, and then throughout the night, a volley of special guests and experts, and of course, at the half, we'll open up the phone lines, taking some of your calls as well on this. Richard, a very exciting night. I'm almost feeling like we're with Cronkite and Wally Schirra all over again.
This is an amazing night. We've just had crusade stage separation. So now Odyssey is relaying data live. I'm watching a couple of screens here, one live from JPL on NASA TV. Everybody who has cable or satellite, if you find NASA TV on your thingy, you can watch it and listen to us at the same time, which is what I'm doing. On my computer, I've got a live computer simulation from JPL, which is giving us moment-by-moment relay from the DSN feedback from what the spacecraft is actually doing in this extremely interesting interactive program called Eyes on the Solar System. You can Google that, and it will take you to the website. And, of course, you'll crash the website. So let's see if we can actually crash NASA's website tonight. We're in incredible shape. The entry vehicle is now being despun from its 2 revs per minute. They're ejecting a couple of balance masses, very large tungsten slabs weighing about 165 pounds apiece, about the size of a laptop computer. And what they do that for is so that the aeroshell, the entry vehicle, which is shaped like a cone, like the Apollo command module you may have seen on television or on movies or, you know, if you Google, is actually unbalanced. And the masses appear to be ejected. We're looking now at an aerodynamic entry. So what they're going to do, this is the first robotic, George, guided landing.
This is incredible.
By remote control. Yeah. We have no astronauts in this.
This rover is not going to bounce in a big balloon the other ones.
This is a very complicated procedure where it enters at 13,000 miles an hour. The peak heating is about 15 seconds after that, up to almost 4,000 degrees on the surface of the heat shield. Then the heat shield has to drop away. The supersonic parachute has to pop out. After the speed is decreased from around 13,000 down to 1,000 miles an hour, which take place in, as I said, less than a minute. And then the supersonic parachute falls all the way down, lowers it down from 1,000 miles an hour to around 200 miles an hour, where the back shell, as it's called, falls away, exposing the radars and a very complicated mechanism consisting of a basic rocket backpack with angled engines that looks like something right out of Buck Rogers, which will lower this thing the last mile. And then when it gets around 150 feet off the surface, something called a sky crane enters into the picture. This rover, which has now deployed its wheels, will be lowered down on steel cables down about
just amazing.
Feet. Oh, it looks like it's like something out of Rube Goldberg.
Hey, Richard, I'm going to pull up NASA right now, and I want you to listen in with me and explain some of the things that they're talking about. They're all excited, and they're all chattering and clapping. So let's go to NASA right now with Richard C. Hoagland and see if we can hear anything.
Here we are. Because we might actually get some pictures, if all goes well, and we might be murky and covered with dust when we first land. But we might get some pictures today.
Landing.
Just a few minutes after landing.
Excellent. Okay, we're standing by.
Thank you.
This is right out of NASA.
Yeah, that's Alex Chen, who is the voice of NASA landing tonight. You know, 43 years and a couple weeks ago, we had the anniversary of Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin landing on the moon.
That's right.
There's no Neil Armstrong, as one of the guys said this afternoon, in this thing. It's all being done by a computer. But what's amazing, this is Neil Armstrong's birthday tonight.
Oh, that's great. Let's go back to NASA for a little bit, Richard, see what they're saying. I mean, the place is packed. It's full of people all over the place. They've all got headphones on.
And they're all wearing their blue Curiosity Mars t-shirts.
Are these all NASA employees,
these
Richard?
All NASA. This is JPL. This is all the flight crew, all the various systems, flight dynamics, guidance, temperature control, communications, all kinds of subsystems. Remember, there's nobody in this thing. It's the biggest rover ever sent.
We're now 5 minutes to entry.
Anywhere to land on another planet.
Continue to receive heartbeat tones. Everything is good.
So far, everything's good. They're talking about a re-entry, Richard, in about, 5 minutes or something?
Well, it's not re, it's entry.
Entry.
And it's a entry minus 4 minutes, 40 seconds and counting. I'm looking at a countdown clock on one of my displays. I can see Mars coming up very big now on the screen. Exquisite simulation using actual real imagery in this computer program. The spacecraft is at the right angle for entry. I mean, when you hit an atmosphere at 13,000 miles an hour, you're going to know it. And the temperatures will flash up immediately. And as I said, it's an intense about 30, 40 seconds. And then it will be slowed from this enormous velocity. You know, something like 10, 11 Gs, if you had an astronaut in there, they'd be crushed into their couches on their back. This is the first spacecraft, by the way, George, which is on the order of a human mission. This is like a compact car entering the atmosphere of Mars.
No, you're right. If there were humans in this vehicle right now, and it was, you know, it would land safely, we'd have men on Mars right now.
You got it. Yeah. And it's the first step in the technology, you know, primitive rockets, et cetera, to take human beings to Mars.
Well, I was going to say, though, if we're able to do this with machinery now in 2012, great year, by the way, why are we talking about 2030?
Exactly. It's all political.
It doesn't make any sense.
We will spend the next, you know, program tonight, 4 hours, discussing why the published NASA plans are crazy compared to what we can do now and what we could do if we put any energy and any investment as a culture, as a nation, as a civilization into pushing back this crucial frontier for the survival and success of the human race.
Richard, will we know almost instantly if this has been a successful landing?
Well, up until about 10 minutes ago, we didn't know. But we now know that Odyssey, which is the communications relay tonight, spacecraft after Arthur Clarke's same movie, 2001, A Space Odyssey, which orbited Mars back in 2001, is acting in a relay mode tonight, and that turn, so the antennas are focused on Odyssey, and the antennas are focused on Curiosity and Earth, so that we get a live relay. All that worked as of about 10 minutes ago, so we will be getting live data relay of the landing all the way through the landing, including what happens when Curiosity goes over the horizon, as seen from Earth. I mean, this is the most bizarre planning, and later on the evening I'm going to discuss some of the not-so-obvious NASA reasons why they set it up this way. But fortunately, this spacecraft, Odyssey, which was ailing up until just a few minutes ago, and they didn't know whether it would actually work, is working perfectly. Apparently, they've got data lockup. They've got real live data being transmitted by a UHF through it back to Earth. All the times I'm quoting, by the way, are Earth-received times. Remember, everything that's going on has already happened at Mars 14 minutes earlier.
Oh, that's right. And by the way, anybody who has a computer close by your radio, or maybe you're listening to us on the computer, we've got a direct link to NASA for you at coasttocoastam.com. It is a live picture with live broadcast. You can follow along with Richard as we watch this hopefully successful landing. So just go to coasttocoastam.com. Under the highlight reel, you can click the NASA link, and there you are. Richard, I got to also say this. I've been broadcasting almost all my whole life, and the technology right now is so incredible. It makes this so exciting. It is almost as if you and I are sitting in that NASA room right now watching this with all those folks.
Oh, exactly. I mean, this takes me back 43 years to the early evening when I was at JPL with, you know, Cronkite and on the East Coast in New York with the entire CBS network at my disposal. And I didn't have as much technology to actually experience and understand what was going on then as I do now sitting here at Enterprise, 1,000 miles away from JPL, plugged in by satellites, looking at live television, live computer screens, live simulation. I mean, this is an astonishing development in only 43 years for the ordinary person. There's nothing I'm looking at tonight that nobody else in this audience, the Coast audience, cannot do all by themselves by simply Googling Eyes on the Solar System and plugging into the software.
I know you worked hard with Cronkite, but I'm going to do my quick Cronkite impression with you there. Ready?
I'm here.
Richard, go get me some water.
He never said that.
They would do that to me. Boy, in my day, was, no, get coffee, do this, do that.
My moon stuff. What and the? I tried to, and I had a commentary tale of like 15 or 20 union guys. They wouldn't let me pick up one prop. I was followed across the floor of the broadcast studio by this trail of people carrying all the stuff that I'd assembled to present on the air of the moon landing.
Let's go back to NASA for a moment and listen in on them.
This time, it'll begin pressurizing the propulsion system to increase the thrust of the system. We'll use that for all the maneuvering in the atmosphere we're about to do.
They're showing pictures of Mars right now and graphics and stuff like that. And, a lot of anxious people there, Richard.
Start of guided entry.
So is Richard, is the entry underway now?
The entry is underway. We're seeing entry gases, plasma around the heat shield. We're going to have guided entry here. Heading alignment is coming up in 1 minute where they reorient. What they do is they roll this aeroshell, and by rolling it, they can change the pitch up or down. That changes whether they land long or short. So it's literally they're flying with the onboard computer this thing through the upper atmosphere at 13,000 miles an hour, using it as a kind of a high-altitude surfboard. So they're surfing the atmosphere to come right down within a few hundred feet of the X marks the spot landing site in the middle of the so-called landing ellipse.
Okay, what could go wrong?
Well, everything. Oh. There are 76 pyrotechnic events that have to happen.
Oh.
These are small explosive devices. Every one has to happen on time, on schedule. Metal could stick, circuits could break, you know, thermal overloads could overload the computer so that it, you know, lost its memory. A cosmic ray could hit at the wrong time and, you know, overload a buffer. There's a million things that could go wrong, but so far everything is going right, and I'm looking. We're at 3,600 miles an hour. We're slowing down. We're 11.24 miles altitude. Our distance from the landing site is about 65 miles. And time to entry is plus 2 minutes. It's a 7 minutes of terror, as they describe this. So we're about one-third of the way through the 7 minutes. And the next thing is going to be popping the heat shield off and then releasing the parachute when we get down to around 1,000 miles an hour. We're at 2,300. We're at 2,200 now. We're at 2,100. This is all atmospheric braking.
This is amazing. I haven't seen this much excitement with a space program in God knows how long.
This is the biggest thing since Buzz and Neil landed on the moon 43 years ago. This is the biggest thing NASA's ever attempted. Politically, I don't have to tell you, we're going to go into it in the next 3.5 hours, all that's riding on this mission. I mean, if this fails, NASA, in terms of being our space program, is pretty much in deep trouble. But I'm watching this computer simulation. Saturn is on the eastern horizon, just setting beyond the eastern horizon, beyond Gale Crater. I can see the Mars landing site, MSL.
Well, when we come back, Richard, hopefully you're going to be able to tell us some pretty good news. And again, go to coasttocoastam.com. We've got the NASA link for you. And, of course, we're always interactive. We'll take your phone call starting next hour here on Coast to Coast AM as you can talk with our just our litany of guests here as we are witnessing history again, folks, as a Mars rover, it's called Curiosity, within the next several minutes is supposed to touch down on Mars. We will be right back, hopefully, with some exciting news. Gentlemen, what you're hearing NASA right now. Curiosity has successfully landed on Mars. Richard, they're going crazy there.
They're on Mars again.
Everything worked.
It worked incredible, incredible. 500,000 lines of code had to be gone through in that little computer to get this thing down safely. 500,000 lines of code.
This is exciting.
Pyrotechnics. I'm watching it on the computer, and it actually, because of the parachute thing, it wasn't synced up exactly because there's always variances in the atmosphere in the real world. But they are going ballistic because this thing has landed safely on Mars. Curiosity is down on
just
Mars.
Happened.
Now,
just
the
happened.
Next thing to watch for, we might get a picture.
All right, Rich, we're going to take this quick break. We're going to come right back and get right into this with you on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie, along with Richard C. Hoagland. What you're hearing now is a live broadcast sound from NASA engineers there jumping for joy, hugging each other as the Mars Curiosity has successfully landed on Mars. And Richard, I got to tell you, if you don't feel pride and patriotic at this moment with American technology, people, you're missing something. It's phenomenal.
George,
go ahead, Richard.
We have pictures.
Pictures, tell me.
What are we? Thumbnail that came down. See, the Odyssey relay only works as long as Odyssey is above the horizon. It's very far east of the spacecraft, so that it was giving us a low pass on this one. In 2 hours, it'll be flying directly overhead, which will give us much better signal strength in the longer time frame. They got the first picture down. It's a black and white thumbnail. It's with the covers on, the transparent covers. It's looking toward the sun, towards sunset. The local time on Mars, where Curiosity is now landed, is about 3:30 p.m. in the afternoon, and the picture is supposed to be terrible quality. I mean, that was pre-advertisement. It's actually excellent quality. Can you imagine what the color and the 3D are going to look like?
You know, because it's coast to coast, I'll say this, Richard. Could you imagine a family on Mars sitting in their backyard watching this thing come down?
Yes, I can well imagine that. I can imagine that several million years ago, when our data says that something like that could in fact have happened, but we'll get into that later on the season.
Was this built primarily by all American technology?
Yes, this is totally. Well, we have a lot of international partners who build subsystems, but it's integrated by Lockheed Martin. It's obviously managed by NASA and JPL. It's American engineers. It's American scientists, American talent. You know, these are high-paying jobs. This is what this country can do when it sets its mind to doing big, difficult things. Remember what John Kennedy said about going to the moon. We choose to go to the moon not because it is easy, but because it is hard. If cultures don't do hard, important things, they become second-rate cultures, and we are in danger if we don't follow this up with a lot more like this of becoming a second-rate global culture. Because remember, we now have competitors, China, Russia, Europe, who are equally able to do this, only they don't have the drive and the spirit, pun intended, that Americans have just exemplified tonight.
Richard, Dr. John Brandenburg is going to be with us for the entire hour, next hour, but he's on the line with us now, too. John, you've got to be excited about this one.
I sure am. And hello, Richard.
Hi, John.
Richard, I think especially you should draw a little credit for this moment, because Mars was just about was declared a dead planet before we began our your Mars investigations that sucked me in, and and we suddenly made Mars was red hot.
Well, as we're going to lay out over the rest of the hours that we have to discuss this, there are several clues coming out of no less an authority than the White House that this mission, Curiosity, might be where NASA finally unveils a hint of the real Mars, the Mars that's all around this rover now, only waiting to be debuted on global television.
We will discuss this, yes.
John, I can't wait to get you back on in about 20 minutes. Okay, my friend.
Very good. It's a great moment to be an American.
It's going to be exciting.
See you soon, John.
Okay, we'll talk to you soon.
Absolutely.
Bye-bye.
Dr. John Brandenburg, author, Life and Death on Mars, will be with us at 11 o'clock to 12. He'll take some of your phone calls as well. You know, Richard, since 9/11, this country has gone through all kinds of things. I think this is just so important, I think, to everybody on this planet, everybody that lives in the United States, everybody that says that they're Americans. I think we needed a boost like this.
Well, this is an extraordinary example of what we can do when we do things together, when we tackle big, important things, because there's everything from the science. What's on Mars? Is there life? This mission could answer that question if NASA will politically, you know, make the actual announcement. But there's also the political, there's the economic, there's the cultural, there's the social, there's the metaphysical, the religious implications. Nothing about this is trivial. In fact, it's not an overhype to say this is probably the most important night in NASA's history, in the United States history, in space, since Neil and Buzz landed on the moon.
For one brief moment, I hope people can push aside the economy, the wars, and everything else. There is, of course, a cloud today, Richard, with that horrible shooting of the Sikh temple victims in Wisconsin. Very sad story as well in the middle of this euphoria on this Mars landing.
Well, this is a very big and diverse and sprawling culture. On every given day, there are murders in all the major cities. There are people starving. There are people undergoing terrible privation. A society has to think of all its citizens. It has to do the things that will make everybody richer. And as I've said over and over on this show, we now have mathematical proof going back to the 70s that for every dollar invested in NASA, in the high-tech demonstration of capability, the culture gets richer by something between $10 and $30. So this is not a lost leader. This mission tonight is costing $2.5 billion, but over the next 20 years, we will be 20 times, 30 times richer as a culture because of what we know we're creating by doing things like this. And that's not counting the things we don't know, such as, is this going to be the mission where NASA announces we have found life on Mars?
If you were over at JPL right now in Pasadena, would you be jumping for joy and sharing wine with your colleagues?
And probably wearing a blue T-shirt.
And they're all doing it. They really are.
I've never seen so many happy people. Look at them. You can see them on the screen. You know, and they deserve to be. This has been a 10-year process of very dedicated people who have lost, you know, marriages. They've not seen their kids. They worked overtime. They haven't been paid for overtime. They put their heart and soul, their blood, sweat, their tears. Look at that woman. She's crying with joy because now the hard part is over.
And let me ask you, Richard, when we landed the rovers Opportunity and Spirit, we expected them to last just a few months.
90 days.
And I mean, one of them is still going.
Opportunity.
I mean, they're like the ever-ready bunny.
Yep.
How long is this mission planned for?
If I told you how long some NASA people are talking about running this thing, you would not believe me.
I believe everything you say. Well, almost everything.
Almost, yes. Almost. All right. Remember, this is the first rover on another world which has a nuclear power source.
Okay.
It has a snap nuclear reactor in the back.
Unlike the other two that worked on solar panels.
Solar panels, and of course on Mars you have dust. And when the solar panels get dusted, unless they're cleaned by, you know, dust storms or whirlwinds, ultimately you wind up losing electricity, and that ends the mission. That's what basically happened with Spirit. It didn't have enough energy to run the wheels to dig itself out from that little sand dune that it got stuck in. Opportunity has been very fortunate in that on the other side of Mars, it's still able to do its task, but it's so minimal compared to MSL, compared to Curiosity. This is a car on Mars, run by an autonomous robot, run by nuclear energy. The nuclear energy power pack itself could let this thing, get this, George, based on other experience with nuclear missions like Voyager and Cassini and some of the Navy missions. I mean, we have the Voyagers out there tonight, 30-some years after they left Earth, still broadcasting because they're using nuclear power, right?
You got that right.
So if you forecast MSL, a prognosticated drop-dead date from power and energy alone, this thing could be operating on Mars when human beings join it.
That's amazing. That's not only amazing, it's exciting. Now, when they talk about search for microbial life, how is this thing going to do this? Does it have some little Testers, what are they going to do?
Well, it has 10 instruments. It's about almost 200 pounds of instruments, and you don't actually measure the value of the science by the poundage, although you can use that as a rule of thumb. The key thing is it's got chem labs. It's got, I mean, look, we've sent this rover to Mars, and it's got a science fiction ray gun on board. It's going to be able to zap rocks and other things out to between 30 and 50 feet and be able to analyze the little bright speck of light from repeated zapping with this laser, this million-watt laser buried in the belly of the beast and comes up through fiber optics and comes out the mast. And it will be able to analyze objects in an area that's almost 1,000 square feet around the rover. Now, on the previous rovers, you know, you see a whole bunch of things you want to drive over and take a close-up look, right? Well, you don't have time. So while it's going someplace from target A to target B, it can be analyzing by remote laser blast objects, rocks in the distance 30, 40, 50 feet away and giving us readings as to what they're made of. Later on in the morning, I'm going to discuss some other uses for this, but I find it amazing that we've sent a robot to Mars right out of science fiction that is carrying its own ray gun.
It's exciting. Now, you specifically, you joined with Sir Charles Schulz III. He's talked about fossils on Mars. What happens with the sensitivity of this camera on Curiosity if they spot something that everybody knows is probably some form of some past life?
This is back to the political question. I think that we're going to actually see in this mission a break with what's happened over the last 30, 40 years. The official guys, I've been watching, obviously, every briefing. I was up until 6 a.m. this morning watching a briefing replay that I'd missed earlier in the day yesterday. And I am hearing officials, high officials in NASA, talking about Curiosity maybe spotting fossils.
That's
now, that
exciting.
Means politically, and we'll talk about that later in the morning, if our trend curve, other data, is accurate, this could be the mission where NASA comes clean and starts talking about actually what's there on Mars. The other thing that could happen, of course, and it could happen even in the first month when they're going to be very, very, very cautious in getting this thing unlimbered and, you know, basically on the road, mm-hmm. moving from where the landing is to where it wants to go, which is the top of this, you know, 3-mile-high mountain in the center of this almost 100-mile crater called Gale Crater, which is an amazing odyssey, and we're going to be talking about that a lot in the coming weeks and months and maybe even years. The point is that they're already discussing, as it's sitting there and they're looking at systems and warming this up and, you know, unlatching that and moving this mechanism and making sure everything mechanically is working, they're going to be doing their first atmospheric analyses in the chem lab, one of the chem labs on board, and that analysis is going to include, and again, they have specifically talked about this, they're going to be trying to measure the methane ratios of the isotopes, carbon-12 versus carbon-13. Carbon-13 is naturally evolved. It's an abiotic material. Carbon-12 is what life on Earth exclusively uses to run all of our biology. No matter what organism you look at, from microbes to dinosaurs to human beings, carbon-12 is what we're made of. And with a smidgen of carbon-14 that's ingested from cosmic rays bombarding the atmosphere and turning nitrogen-14 into carbon-14. Well, they're looking right away and talking about it, that they're going to be looking at these ratios because, as you know, going back several years, going back the most recent to 2009, there was a major announcement about atmospheric changes in methane found in the atmosphere from observatories on Earth, as well as from some of the satellites like Mars Express that are orbiting Mars even now, even tonight. That ratio is basically a big mystery. Way, is there an isotope component which tells us there might be biology producing the methane? And if that's true, then does this explain why the methane is there at all? Because methane, when it's exposed in an ordinary atmosphere on a planet close to the sun like Mars or Earth, it has a half-life, meaning half of it will go away in only a few hundred years. Unless there was a constant replenishment of this methane, which on Earth comes from cows doing things I can't say on live national radio, and there are no cows, we don't think we've seen them on Mars. So where is this methane coming from? There are two possibilities in our model. One is that the methane is coming from live organisms under the surface somewhere on Mars, colonies maybe of microbes, maybe of, you know, whatever kind of microbial life you want to imagine, and it's venting to the surface, and that's why we're seeing these seasonal changes. The microbes grow in the spring and summer, and they go into hibernation in the fall and winter,
okay.
And that's why you see a seasonal change. The other possibility, George, is we're seeing fossil methane released from decaying vegetation from a previous lush life epoch on Mars that was destroyed when Mars went through its catastrophe, which we've been looking at in our various examinations over the last 30 years. This mission, this Curiosity mission, I don't know how aptly named it is, could in fact tell us which of those two ideas is right.
What can you tell us, Richard, about the landing site, Gale Crater?
It's extraordinary. As I said on an earlier show, in fact, if people go to the COAST website and do a search under my name and earlier shows, I did a show where I actually gave Lex some illustrations,
okay.
Some images, which are posted as part of an article that I wrote just for the COAST audience. I decided instead of posting it again, I'd just let everybody go and look for it. I forget the exact date. You know, when we get to a break, I'll go and look, and I'll actually have a date for you and an actual name so you can just plug in to the search engine there on COAST. But one of the things we're going to be looking at as this thing begins to drive in the next month or two, and it moves toward the top of Mount Sharp, which is what this huge mountain in the middle of this crater, 3 miles high and 100-mile-wide crater is named. It's going to take years to get to the top. But the object itself, the mountain itself, doesn't quite look natural. Mount Sharp, the very peak, looks, in fact, like an eroded tetrahedron.
Like it was built?
Like somebody
chopped
built
away?
It. Like someone built this thing. This is going to sound totally nuts to all my wonderful enemies out there who wanted me to stay very strict and scientific tonight. Hoagland, don't speculate. Hoagland, so I'm not going to do what I normally
They're listening
don't do.
Tonight going, how long is she going to be on with him?
That's exactly what they're saying. They're tearing their hair out now. That little ripping sound you hear are certain people tearing out their hair. Some of them don't have very much hair to begin with in front of their computer screens and the radios. The point is that there is no commonly accepted mechanism of the formation of Mount Sharp in the middle of this crater. I mean, think of it for a minute. You have a 100-mile-wide crater. It's formed by impact, right? To form a 100-mile-wide crater, what do you need? You need an asteroid that's maybe 10 miles across, impacting Mars at escape velocity, creating the explosive energy of several trillion hydrogen bombs, blasting a huge hole in the surface of Mars. How do you get a mountain covering the crater subsequently? Where did this stuff come from to form the mountain?
It was brought there, maybe.
Exactly. Yeah. And some of the photographs that have been taken by MRO, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, that I have on the COAST website, if you go and find that article, they look down on incredibly geometric ruin-like structures photographed right in the path of where Curiosity has to drive from where it landed a few minutes ago to when it gets to the top of Mount Sharp in a year or so.
I got to say, Richard, what a momentous moment tonight, huh?
It is only the beginning. And when John comes on in about 5-10 minutes, we're going to talk about the implications if we're right and the NASA sensors are wrong and the politics are that slowly, painstakingly, NASA is going to start with this mission removing the covers from the eyes of the public around the world and beginning to reveal the Mars that John and I and others have worked to support and document for the last 30-some years. I mean, I've been on this road for 30-some years trying to prove that there has been an exquisite period of inhabited life on the planet Mars, and NASA's been doing everything it can not to tell people the truth, and it may be, given the hints we're seeing and the more hints we're going to talk about later tonight, that this could be the mission where that finally changes.
What kind of a boost is this to our space program and to those skeptics abroad?
Well, it's an enormous boost because now we are the lead dog. You know, the Russians tried to go to the moon Phobos, launching just about the same time within a few days of the launch of Curiosity. And as you know, they didn't make it.
They didn't make it.
Get out of low Earth orbit. So we're now the, you know, as Buzz said on the runway, you know, you're number one on the runway. But we're number one on the runway to find what's on Mars and reveal it to the planet if the politics, as I said, in NASA are finally moving into alignment with where people need to go in order for this culture to resume its leadership of the world as a whole. The jubilation you saw in that control room and the jubilation at among kids and, you know, students and a lot of people around this country plugged in through social media, through Facebook and the Internet and Twitter, is palpable. You can see people overjoyed that we've done something once again that shows that when you release American ingenuity and creativity and engineering and technological expertise and vision, there is nothing we can't solve. That's why all this hand-wringing about the economy and, oh, there's no jobs and all, is pathetic.
Well, let's take just this moment tonight, Richard, and enjoy this moment. We'll be back in a moment with Dr. John Brandenburg, who will join Richard C. Hoagland and me throughout the night, and other guests as well. And, yes, your phone calls, too.